ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A sunny Sale Sunday, an anti-gun control crowd dotted with children turns angry.
I thank you for coming.
John Howard, apparently on the advice of his security staff, took the unprecedented step for a Prime Minister of wearing an anti-shrapnel jacket, the outline visible beneath his coat.
That was back in 1996 when the then Prime Minister John Howard introduced sweeping changes to gun laws after the Port Arthur massacre. Since then, gun ownership in Australia has jumped, with 4 million guns owned by civilians. Today in Australia Wide, we're going to take a look at the proposed national gun buyback scheme to be debated early next week in Parliament. And we head to an isolated corner of New South Wales where nature is enjoying the deluge of water that's coming from the floods in Queensland last year.
I love being able to see what's happening. I mean, we're flying at 50 metres above the water with tape recorders, being like race callers, and identifying and estimating the numbers of birds. So you're busy, but you're also able to take in this magnificent expanse of water.
I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth.
There are more guns now in Australia than there were at the time of the Port Arthur massacre. That is not good enough. The terrorists at Bondi Beach had hatred in their minds, but guns in their hands. This law will deal with both, and we do need to deal with both of these issues.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese earlier this week recalling Parliament to deal with national security legislation in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attack. There are over 4 million firearms owned by civilians in this country, according to the latest Australia Institute figures. That's one for every 7 Australians. That's an uptick of 25% since the Port Arthur massacre 29 years ago, which led to sweeping changes to gun laws and significant restrictions on gun ownership. The Prime Minister has flagged similar changes to back then, and when Parliament meets on Monday to debate the Combating Anti-Semitism, Hate and Extremism Bill, it will discuss a buyback scheme to get guns off the streets. But recreational shooters and farmers are looking to push back on these new restrictions to gun ownership. Doug Alcock, a hunter, clay target shooter and a director of coaching New South Wales Sporting Clays Association, says the proposed changes will hurt farmers and pest animal controllers, and he's not convinced they'll make the community safer.
None of them actually go towards in addressing what occurred at Bondi and the ability of that person to have gained access to firearms. You know, things such as changing the number of firearms someone is allowed to own and use, it makes no sense to me that you take away some firearms from everyone but leave at least 4 firearms with everyone. So if there are bad actors still out there on firearms licences.
Doug Alcock, who is the Director of Coaching at New South Wales Sporting Clays Association. Dr. Samara McFedrin is a violence prevention expert at Griffith University, and she writes widely about gun ownership and violence in Australia. Now, Dr. McFedrin, I do think for the layperson, the idea that there's 4 million guns owned by civilians is a bit of an eye-opener. It is for me, I have to say. Can you make that number make sense to me? Where is the concentration of gun ownership in Australia?
This is a really key question because it underpins many of the debates we're having at the moment. Now, the question we really need to ask is, does the number of legally owned firearms in Australia relate to levels of gun violence? Now, 30 years ago, we said, yes, it does. That was straight after Port Arthur. At the time, based on the evidence we had then, that was a fair assumption to make. But what we've actually found out over the years since 1996 is the opposite has happened. What we've actually seen is a rise in both the number of licensed firearms owners and the number of registered firearms, but we've seen ongoing declines in firearm misuse. So firearm homicide, armed robbery with a firearm, firearm suicide, and even firearm theft in recent years has started to fall. So this isn't a case of more guns means more gun violence. It's actually the opposite. I'm not saying that one causes the other, but what this is telling us is that the number of legally owned guns doesn't seem to bear a relationship to firearm violence and misuse. The legally owned guns aren't the guns on the street. Now, the guns on the street, the ones that tend to get used in violent acts, generally they are not legally owned. They're not owned by licensed people. They're not registered firearms. So to deal with the majority of gun violence that we see in Australia, we actually need to recognise that we're dealing with two quite distinct populations. One is the licensed people with registered firearms. The other is unlicensed people who are in illegal possession of firearms.
Have you taken a look at what is proposed in this legislation, and is it looking at those both of those issues?
I have, and in short, no, it's not. Now, one issue that it is clearly attempting to address actually signposts something that appears to have gone catastrophically wrong in New South Wales. And that is the issue that somebody who was allegedly living with a person who was on an ASIO terrorist watch list was nevertheless able to obtain a firearms licence. Now, the laws in New South Wales at the time already existed to prevent that from happening. Now, we don't know what went wrong such that that individual could get a gun licence. We haven't been told that. But the fact that we're seeing in this bill legislation to remove barriers to information sharing between state and territory police and federal government agencies such as ASIO is very, very suggestive of what actually went wrong. So information sharing of that nature, certainly that makes sense. But the majority of other provisions, no, they won't be expected to impact on violence because they are targeting primarily the lawful trade in firearms, not the illegal.
So, I mean, part of this legislation is looking at a national gun buyback. Do you support that idea?
Look, unfortunately, one of the lessons that we've learned in Australia over and over again, and other countries have found this as well, is that buybacks aren't an effective or cost-effective way to address firearm misuse. They get headlines, they make it look as if politicians are doing something, but as a violence prevention measure, they aren't terribly effective. There are much more effective interventions that the money could be spent on to deliver a greater return on investment.
Gun buybacks really do capture the headlines, but they do have real-world impact on people such as those that hunt, shooters associations, farmers that have access to firearms for reasons on the farm. How do you see these new restrictions affecting that community of people?
It depends largely on what the states and territories decide to do. In New South Wales, for example, and Western Australia, where there are now limits on the number of firearms people can own. And certainly it's reasonable to say that that can have an impact on people's participation in shooting activity or also on their occupational needs, particularly if they're farmers or in other rural and agricultural settings. So again, this goes to the underlying premise of those restrictions, which is the assumption that less guns means less gun crime. But the reality is that the types of measures that are being put through or being suggested, they are not actually going to address the high-risk populations.
At the time after Port Arthur, I'm sure I remember, and I'm sure you remember, that very dramatic footage of piles and piles of guns after the buyback. Do you see something similar playing out here?
That's an interesting question, because it seems as if a number of states and territories aren't really interested in going down that path. And in some ways, this actually offers a bit of hope, because since 1996, we've gone down this same path on a number of occasions where there's a violent incident and the political reaction is quick, we have to do something, and that tends to lead to measures like gun buybacks and gun bans and so on. And we've seen that over and over again. But we can't keep on doing the same thing and hoping for a different result. Yet that is what Mr. Albanese seems to want to do. Now, the fact that some of the states and territories are saying, well, hang on, we don't want to do the same thing over and over again because we're not going to get a different result. We will look at this problem more holistically. We will look at it calmly and take our time to get things right. That does actually offer the hope that this time around, perhaps we will do things differently and potentially get some more effective measures in place that stand a better likelihood of reducing violence. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that federally, and it's still early days to see how all of this plays out.
Well, we shall see. Dr. Samara Mephedron, who's a violence prevention expert at Griffith University, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
Thank you.
The Queensland Premier is warning that sodden catchments in central and western Queensland could be further impacted by more rain following ex-tropical cyclone Koji. Our reporter Liam O'Connell is in Claremont. Liam, firstly, can you describe the impact of the floods that have affected central and western Queensland following the cyclone?
Yeah, absolutely, Sinead. So it did track a lot further south than was originally expected by the Bureau, so crossing between Bowen and Eyre, and that's meant that it's made a path with the south of it, which normally cops the brunt of the system, through Mackay and then through the Pioneer Valley, which is western Mackay, and then out to the Isaac region in places like Moranbah and Dysart, and where we are today in Clermont. In the Pioneer Valley, it has meant that there was very rapid river rises, falls of up to 400 millimetres, which sent lots of river flowing through the Pioneer catchment. That produced major flooding at Morani, about 36 kilometres west of Mackay, moderate flooding at Mackay itself, but no homes impacted there so far. Some homes impacted in the upper Pioneer Valley in Finch Hatton. Now further west, it really has caused quite a lot of grief. Here in Clermont, we've had it updated today, 70 homes were actually impacted when on Monday afternoon, the waters rose very, very quickly, according to the locals we've been speaking with. It just came up in the local lagoon, which is Hood's Lagoon, and they say it came up nearly from nothing to nearly shin height, ankle height within the space of half an hour. So not a lot of time for people to prepare, and for graziers especially, and for people who've had their homes inundated, some decently significant losses.
Liam, like you said, there was very little time to prepare, and you were speaking to Robin Cross, who's from Claremont Community Housing. Let's have a listen to what she had to say.
We're the local stop shop for people that need assistance in Claremont, and we've had to move because we've been flooded. On Monday, the workers rang and said, are we right to go into work? And we said, yeah. I said, yeah, go in and just see how things are going. And within an hour and a half of them being there, they had to evacuate because the building didn't have water in it at that stage, but they couldn't get their cars out. The building was becoming an isolated island.
That's Robin Cross from Claremont Community Housing, and she's speaking to our reporter, Liam O'Connell, who's there. Now, the Queensland Premier has raised concerns, Liam, about more forecast rain falling on wet catchments. What's the forecast looking like?
Yeah, so at the moment, their system is heading further west, and that's really a concern for grazers in northwest Queensland. They've already been through weeks of flooding, and they thought that they might have seen the other side of it, but now that ex-tropical cyclone Koji, the remnants of it, is heading that way, hitting on such catchments. One of the key concerns that they have raised is the automatic river gauges that the Bureau of Meteorology runs. They've said that there wasn't enough timely or accurate information coming through to them to actually help make the decisions they needed to make to help protect themselves and help protect their stock. The Queensland Premier has joined with them and said that there needs to be more investment in the Bureau of Meteorology to help give these people, in some cases very isolated places, the timely information they need to keep themselves safe.
And looking at those maps, are there many flood warnings still active in the region?
There is a flood warning, particularly here in central Queensland, just to the east of us between Emerald and at Rockhampton, and that's for the Mackenzie River. That's in an emergency flood warning this afternoon. As of 4 o'clock this afternoon, residents in low-lying areas are being told to leave now, and that flooding may have exceeded previous floods. And the Bureau of Meteorology has warned in particular the Tartarus Gauge near the small township of Dingo may exceed major flood levels. So the Rockhampton Mayor has also come out and said this afternoon that they may be looking at floods next week and that they've told people in low-lying areas to start preparing.
Still a very dynamic situation there, Liam. Liam O'Connell in Claremont, thanks very much for talking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Sinead.
ABC Australia Wide.
In an isolated corner of New South Wales, nature is enjoying a deluge of water that comes from the floods in Queensland last year. The water has flowed down the Boolu River to New South Wales, turning the Karrapundi Swamp into an inland sea. It's a once-in-a-lifetime event, which ecologists have been able to witness firsthand since the government purchased the Narayara Station about 5 years ago and turned it into a national park. Our reporter Catherine Spackman has more.
In one of the remote parts of New South Wales, a desert has been turned into an oasis. Water from historic floods in southwest Queensland early last year have flown down the Boolu River and into the Boolu Overflow and Karrapundi Swamp.
The great thrills of the last couple of months has been able to go and do aerial surveys over, I think, one of the most incredible wetlands that we've got in the country.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime event which ecologists like Professor Richard Kingsford have been able to witness firsthand since the government purchased the Narayara Station about 5 years ago and turned it into a national park.
We know it's big, but when you've actually got to survey it from a light aircraft and it takes you hours to go back and forth, you just realise just what an amazing natural phenomenon this is.
The swamp is a 17-hour drive from Sydney to the Corner Country, not far from the dog fence at the Queensland border, which forms its northern boundary. Professor Kingsford, who's a University of New South Wales river ecologist, took to the skies recently to do a survey of the wetlands.
We estimate there was probably 200,000 or 300,000 water birds there, maybe even more than that. We think more than 30 species. We have thousands of things like freckled duck, which are a rare species, but over 100,000 grey teal and 70,000 pink-eared duck, and even the swans were breeding there and swamp hens were breeding. I've never seen so many swamp hens in one place. And even one of the sort of enigmas of water birds are these black-tailed native hens, which were all also there in their tens of thousands. And so just an incredible sight to see.
Professor Kingsford says it's the first bird survey done in about 35 years, with birds a good indicator of the health of a system.
I love being able to see what's happening. I mean, we're flying at 50 metres above the water with tape recorders, being like race callers, and identifying and estimating the numbers of birds. So you're busy, but you're also able to take in this magnificent expanse of water.
He says as the water continues to evaporate over the warmer months, the environment has become even more productive.
All those invertebrates and fish that are in the water are going to be available to a whole range of different water birds. And so you'll see these sort of interesting cycles that happen within a cycle as it floods and dries. And I'd expect, you know, there'll be incredible action in terms of what's happening there well until it dries. And then, of course, when it dries, it's sort of got all of this moisture. And so you get all the plants and animals and woodland birds and all of those, and the small mammals will be able to take advantage of that high productivity that's in the system.
Since the New South Wales government purchased the 150,000 hectare Nariara Station about 5 years ago, scientists, rangers and local Indigenous people have been able to appreciate its ecological significance and cultural history. Melian Yapa man Mark Sutton welcomed the arrival of water.
It means that our totem species are being replenished. In our local tribal groups, we have semi-arid desert species like fish, of course, like ducks. My particular totem is the bony bream, or nyamba in language. And that particular species of fish sits in the sand, often for many years, waiting for a deluge of decent rain. Then once that water arrives, either flowing down through systems or from the skies, those eggs hatch, and within weeks, those previous dry lakes can suddenly be full of fish. And people always wondered, well, how could that be if there's no system feeding those particular lakes? But of course, they've been waiting in the sand all along.
Pretty amazing. Mark Sutton speaking to Catherine Spackman. Players from across Western Australia's Great Southern region come together every week for the Albany Filipino Basketball League. It all started 20 years ago by workers who'd come to Australia from the Philippines. Samantha Gerling went along to check it out.
It gets pretty competitive, especially because, like, knowing how we all play with all the mums, all the partners on the sides screaming, it's a good atmosphere to be down and play.
Gabriel Ang is one of the players in the Albany Filipino Basketball League. It draws participants from across Western Australia's Great Southern region.
Especially just have fun, because as a kid, you know, just playing around every day and then growing up to with the big boy leagues and all that.
The competition was started two decades ago by a group of Filipinos who were working in Australia. Manuel de la Merced Jr. is an official of the league and has been there since the start.
One of the Filipino leaders here, Joe Kamakin, he is the one who organized this one, you know, that Filipino will not be become homesick from Philippines coming down here. So we start the league since 2006 and until now. You know, that every Filipino will come down here to see, and we can see each other, and we have a fun every Sunday.
The sport was a reminder of home.
Basketball is like a religion in Philippines. Every Filipino really love to play basketball, to watch basketball, and then they are fanatic of this kind of sports.
Today, there are more than 100 players in the open and over 40s categories, and it's high energy.
The atmosphere is really good, the environment is really good. They love, especially the commentator. They're enjoying the competitor, Mr. Roger Afroki. He's the one who gave energy to the activity.
John Santia has been playing since he moved to Australia in 2008.
My dad got a job from here, so the part of his contract is for his family to come over here. So it's been really good, you know, keep the Filipino culture going every Sunday, every weekend. and, you know, socialise with the family.
A strongly invested community league.
Competitive on every game, yes, because back home, it's the number one sport, so a win is a win for us, you know. And especially we got sponsors and stuff, so we have to be really competitive.
John Santia ending that story from Samantha Garling. And that is Australia-wide for today. I'm Sinead Mangan. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.